Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see so many people out this morning. We want to welcome our visitors. We're glad you chose to be with us. This is the third Sunday of the month, and for those not familiar with what that means, it was mentioned in the announcements, but that means that tonight is our song and scripture service. It's a time that we all look forward to. And you might wonder about this morning's lesson. Last week we started a series on prayer. We're going to pick up with part two of that next Sunday morning. But being the third Sunday of the month, this is our Godly Women series Sunday morning as well that we began back in January. And last month we studied in Esther, and that got us out chronologically out of the Old Testament. And so now this month and next month, as we wrap it up with Mary, the Lord's mother, we'll be finishing that up from the New Testament. This morning's lesson is entitled Godly Women Series Part 8. It's Peter's Wife, Faithful Companion. And last week, as I mentioned to you that we're going to be studying about Peter's wife, I asked you to do some homework and find some passages that either deal with her directly or indirectly. That was the challenge. Well, the three texts that we're going to be looking at this morning that deal two indirectly and one directly are Mark 1, 29 to 31, 1 Corinthians 9, 5, and 1 Peter 5, 1. And incidentally, that's the order, and we're going to be looking at those this morning. At the end of the lesson, we're also going to be referencing some secular writings, and the outline and PowerPoint are already on the website. The very last page of the outline is a sources page, as I often do whenever I cite things that are extra-biblical, and there are 8 quotes or things of that nature by 7 historians. One historian made the list twice, Jerome, so there's 8 quotes, but 7 historians. And I'm not going to read all of those. I'm just going to reference them. So if you would like to look at them, that's on the last page of the outline. And I do have a hard copy of that with me as well if you want to see that after the lesson. What we're going to do is just read one of those quotes as we get to the end. But one of the reasons we've been looking at a Godly Women series is to note that there are examples, both good and bad, in the scriptures. Both men and women alike provide sources of inspiration, strength, and encouragement. Both men and women alike can provide us with example, both good and bad, as we look through the scriptures, both Old and New Testament. And as we looked at in the very beginning, where I'm not going to go through this list, as the list has gotten longer, it takes more time to get through it. So I'm just going to mention the ladies we have studied so far. Eve, Sarah, Ruth, Abigail, the ideal woman's character from Proverbs 31, the Shunammite woman, and then last month we talked about Queen Esther, how she was a brave queen who trusted in God. These are just a few of the many examples there are in the scriptures. This was not to be an all-inclusive or exhaustive Godly Women series, but to provide 9 examples of what it means to be a godly woman, what it means to put your trust in God. And one of the reasons we want to look at these things is because godly role models are greatly needed today. And whether you are married or whether you are single, you can be that godly role model to others. You might wonder, why is Peter's wife on this list? I know some of you have asked me that as I asked you to rank them. Why is Peter's wife on there? We don't even know her name. Well, we didn't know the Shunammite's name either. And yet, that is an extraordinary example of what a godly woman looks like. Knowing her child is dead, she approaches the prophet of God. He asks through his servant, "Is it well?" And she says, "It is well." That's extraordinary. That takes exemplary faith in God and trusting in his goodness and his faithfulness towards his people. Contrary to what the Catholics teach in regards to Peter being celibate and the first pope, Peter did indeed have a wife. In fact, the scriptures are going to define her as a believing wife, meaning she was a Christian. And I'm briefly going to talk about these three passages, and then we're going to look at them in greater detail. But in Mark 1, 29 to 31, it's also found in Matthew 8, 14 to 15, and Luke 4, 38 to 39, 3 out of the 4 Gospels mention this account that Jesus and a couple of his apostles enter the home of Simon and Andrew, that's Peter and Andrew's home, and there they find Peter's mother-in-law. Luke describes her having a high fever. And they tell Jesus about her. He goes to her and heals her. There's an interesting note about that. In order for you to have a mother-in-law, what must your relationship be? What must your relationship status be? married, right? In order for you to have a mother-in-law, you must be married. So for Peter to be, or to, for Peter to have a mother-in-law, he is married. So the implication here is he is married. This is one of those indirect mentions of Peter's wife. You must be married to have a mother-in-law. In 1 Corinthians 9:5, we're told she was a Christian and traveled with Peter. Here is the only direct biblical account of Peter having a wife. This is the direct mention of Peter's wife. In 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 1, Peter exhorts the elders as their fellow elder. To be an elder, what is your marital status? You have to be married. We know that from so many other passages. 1 Timothy 3:2, Titus chapter 1, 6. So we know she was an elder's wife. This is an indirect passage dealing with Peter's wife, but it tells us so much about her, knowing just the qualifications to be an elder. So like the Shunammite woman from 2 Kings 4, we don't even know her name. But from what is recorded about her, and it is a short account of what is recorded about her, we see that she was a faithful companion. One of the first things we note about her character is she was hospitable. In Mark chapter 1, 29 to 31, it reads this way. And immediately after they came out of the synagogue, they came into the house of Simon and Andrew with James and John. So Jesus has brought in James and John into Simon and Andrew's house. This tells us a lot about the hospitality that this home had. Now Simon's mother-in-law was lying sick with a fever, and immediately they spoke to Jesus about her. And he came to her and raised her up, taking her by the hand, and the fever left her, and she waited on them. So while in Capernaum, we can go back to Mark chapter 1, verse 21, they're in Capernaum, and after teaching in the synagogue, you know the interesting thing about this, tying all the dots together, you can turn to Luke 7, 1 to 5, and find that the synagogue here in Capernaum was built by the centurion whose servant needed healed, who told Jesus, just say the word and it'll be done. This is where the synagogue came from that Jesus is in teaching. So Jesus and a few of his apostles, Mark 1:29 tells us it's James and John, enter into Peter and Andrew's home and healed Peter's mother-in-law. Luke 4:38 tells us she had a high fever. Once healed, she immediately got up and waited on Jesus. The interesting thing to me here, it doesn't say Peter's wife, but the one who was sick got up and waited on them. And as you look through the Matthew account, the Luke account, and the Mark account here it says she waited on them, meaning all those in the house that were there. In other passages, it says waited on him, meaning she was waiting on Jesus. One of the interesting things here about the way this is worded, especially if you look in the Luke 4 account, Luke 4:38, Andrew brought Peter to Jesus, going back to John 1:35 to 42. And here, Peter and Andrew bring Jesus home to Peter's mother-in-law who needed help. One of the lessons we can take from this short account is bring those you know to Jesus. Teach them the gospel. Bring Jesus into your homes and to your family. Teach the gospel and be the example that Jesus calls you to be to your children, to your spouse, to all those in your home. Matthew 5:16 says we're to let our light shine in such a way that others see our good works. And they glorify our Father who is in heaven. On the note of being hospitable, it's interesting in 1 Timothy 3:2, we're going to find out later that Peter is an elder. But one of the things elders are told to be as part of their qualifications is elders had to be hospitable. And we see very early on in Peter's life as a disciple of Jesus, he was just that along with his family. Peter invited Jesus and some of the other apostles to stay in their home. As you continue reading in Mark chapter 1, starting in verse 32 to 34, it's going to tell us the whole city gathered at the door. This is a very large crowd. A whole city, it says, gathered at the door. The idea there is, whether that's figurative or literally, the people of Capernaum were interested in Jesus. They follow him from the synagogue. They go to Simon and Andrew's house. They're gathered at the door. She would have been host. Peter's wife, Peter and his wife, would have been host. We're told in Matthew chapter 9, 1 to 7, Jesus came to Capernaum as, quote, his own city. He was of Nazareth, but as he became an adult, he called Capernaum his home, because that's where his home was. If you go to Mark chapter 2, 1 to 12, it tells us this was Jesus' home. It's possible that Peter's home was the setting of where the paralytic was healed, where the crowd, because of the crowd, the rooftop was removed, because this is where Jesus was when he was in Capernaum. And so it's very possible that they took off Peter and Andrew's roof to lower the paralytic down. Peter and his wife opened their home to his mother-in-law. Whether she was living with them or just visiting on this occasion, we're not told, but they opened up their home to her, to Andrew. Apparently, it's called the house of Simon and Andrew. They lived together. So he lived there with his brother. They opened up their home to Jesus and the apostles, and even the crowds from the city. Hebrews 13, 1 to 2 tells us all saints are to be hospitable. This is to be a trait all of us are to have. And we see it in a very early on in Peter and his household. And not only along with Peter would she be hospitable, she would have been benevolent. In Matthew 8, 14 to 15, Mark 1, 29 to 31, and Luke 4, 38 to 39, the three accounts of this occasion, we find in light of their actions here, we can infer they were caring for her mother. Either she was living with them or because of the sickness, they brought her into their home. We're not told, but the point is they were caring for her. And when Jesus entered the home, we're told they were so worried about her, they went and told Jesus about her. In verse 30, it says, "Now Simon's mother-in-law was lying sick with a fever, and immediately they spoke to Jesus about her." I want you to look over in the Luke account. Turn over to Luke chapter 4. If memory serves me right, when you look at the Matthew account, if you go to Matthew chapter 8, it says when they entered the house, Jesus saw her lying there. But Mark and Luke tell us that they directed his attention to where she was at. If you go to Luke chapter 4, starting in verse 38, says, "Then he got up and left the synagogue and entered Simon's home. Now Simon's mother-in-law was suffering from a high fever, and they asked him to help her. And standing over her, he rebuked the fever, and it left her. And she immediately got up and waited on them." So he comes into the house. He's been teaching in the synagogue there. The crowds are following him. You can just kind of picture this whole event. They follow him into the house. He only takes a couple of the apostles. James and John come in the door with him. So now there's Peter and Andrew, James and John, and Jesus there. And they direct his attention to Peter's mother-in-law lying there sick with a high fever. And he heals her. They were worried about her high fever, and they tell Jesus about it. From this short account, we can see she was hospitable and benevolent, as was her husband, Peter. As we can read of this account with Peter, it's implied about his wife. And we can turn over to 1 Corinthians 9:5, the only account that we're going to look at this morning that directly mentions her. She's referred to as a believing wife. So we find her as Saul of Tarsus has converted and become Paul, and he's writing to the church at Corinth. He mentions in chapter 9, verse 5, about Peter. He says, "Do we not have a right to take along a believing wife, even as the rest of the apostles and the brothers of the Lord and Cephas?" You might say, well, that doesn't say Peter. Well, we can turn to John chapter 1, verse 42. When Andrew brings Peter to Jesus, Jesus says, "You're Peter. From now on, you'll be called Cephas." And then it puts in parentheses, translated as Peter. So Simon, Cephas, Peter, all talking about the same guy. So he specifically mentions Cephas. He says, "Do we not have a right to take along a believing wife, even as the rest of the apostles?" So this infers that the rest of the apostles are married. "And the brothers of the Lord," implies that Jesus' brothers were also married. "And Cephas." Would not Peter be listed there under the apostles? Yet he singly marks him out. That tells me that his wife traveled with him. At the time of Paul's writing in 1 Corinthians, Peter had a believing wife. She was known to travel with him. This is a direct mention of Peter's wife, but no name is dropped. So she had Jesus as a guest in her house. Matthew chapter 8, verse 14, as we read there in Mark 1, 29 to 31, at least on the day her mother was healed. And it's possible, as we looked at those other passages, that that was a home that Jesus called home while he was in Capernaum, because of the structure of the other passages. So we cannot be surprised at her faith in light of what we know took place in Capernaum. Jesus spent a great deal of time in Capernaum. That's where it was said his home was. He called it his home. And he performed many miracles there. We can look in Matthew 8, 5 to 13 and see this included the healing of the centurion's paralyzed servant. We can find the paralytic carried by four friends, Mark 2, 1 to 12. Peter's mother-in-law, Matthew 8, 14 to 15, and the other two passages in Mark 1 and Luke 4. And the nobleman's son in John chapter 4, 46 to 54. All four Gospels record miracles of Jesus in Capernaum. In fact, we're told he spent so much time there that when the people on the whole did not believe in him, he pronounced judgment on them, saying, "Think of all the things you have seen in your midst." And he pronounced judgment on them. You can read his judgment, Matthew 11, 23 to 24, and Luke 10 and verse 15. 1 Corinthians 9, 5 tells us so much of her faithfulness when we consider what Peter went through. There is faithfulness in hardship. In Mark chapter 1, 16 to 18, Matthew 19, 27, Peter was called by Jesus. He left his job. He left everything. They had a house in Capernaum large enough to house his brother Andrew, his mother-in-law, possibly even Jesus. And it's possible that when he tells Jesus later on in Mark chapter 10, "We've left everything to follow you," it's possible he lost it all. His family business was fishing, and he apparently was doing very well for himself. But he tells Jesus in Mark chapter 10, "We've left everything for you. We've left everything." There would have been some hardship there. Being a disciple of Jesus probably didn't pay as well as it did being a fisherman. His wife would have been there with him. Persecution and imprisonment. These don't just affect one person. It affects the whole family. In Acts chapter 4, 1 to 3, Peter, along with the other apostles, is imprisoned by the Sanhedrin, and they are released. But then in chapter 5, 17 to 19, they're again arrested and put, it says, in a public jail. Her husband would have been made a public spectacle by the Jewish Sanhedrin. Then we can read at the end of Acts 5, 40 through 41, he, along with the other apostles, was flogged by his own countrymen. She would have seen those scars. She would have seen those wounds and those stripes. And then we can look in Acts chapter 12, 1 to 5. After his friend James is beheaded by Herod, it's so popular among the people that Herod has Peter arrested with the intent to execute him as well. As we read there in Acts chapter 12, about the people, the church gathered together praying in John Mark's mother's house, it's very possible his wife could have been numbered among those people, praying on his behalf fervently. We can only speculate as to whether she was there praying for him in Mary's house, the mother of John Mark. We do know that Peter had a close relationship with John Mark. In fact, in 1 Peter 5:13, he refers to him as "my son." And we'll talk about that when we get to 1 Peter 5. But Peter's life had its share of up and downs. In Luke chapter 22, 55 to 62, he denied Jesus three times. And he went out weeping bitterly. We can only imagine who he would go to for consolation, for comfort in that time. In Galatians 2, 11 to 14, he was publicly called out by Paul for his hypocritical behavior. Yeah, it wasn't always a happy life being an apostle's wife. But she knew Jesus, and like her husband, she chose to dedicate her life to following him. To the point that by the time Paul is writing 1 Corinthians, he refers to her as a believing wife. She was a believing wife and a faithful companion. And then we turn to their later years, and we find in 1 Peter 5:1, it says, "Therefore I exhort the elders among you, as your fellow elder and witness of the sufferings of Christ, and a partaker also of the glory that is to be revealed." Peter was an elder, so his wife was an elder's wife. In 1 Timothy 3:2 and Titus 1:6, we're told that elders had to be married. They had to be the husband of one wife, so Peter was married, and he is so by the time he is in his elder years. In 1 Timothy 3, 3-4, to be an elder, one had to have children. So Peter and his wife had children. So we can infer from that she's also a mother. She's not only a fisherman's wife, a Christian's wife, an apostle's wife, and an elder's wife, she's also a mother. But we also know from Titus 1, 5-6, that to be an elder, an elder's children must be believing. And whether you interpret that to mean all their children, or at least one of those children, meaning some of the children, their children were Christians. They raised faithful, godly children in order for Peter to be an elder. And so, we find that Peter's wife was an elder's wife. And she would have had a hand in raising faithful children. 1 Peter 5:1, Titus 1:5-6. I'm going to look over with me in Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 6. Proverbs chapter 22, verse 6, says, "Train up a child in the way he should go. Even when he is old, he will not depart from it." Parents have a responsibility to train our children up in the knowledge of God. We have that responsibility. We can see here that she and Peter raised faithful children, and she likely played a major role in her children's physical and spiritual development. We think of their children. Although the scriptures don't mention Peter's children, we don't even know how many. We know they had godly parents because of what we know of Peter and what we know of his wife. Some people ask the question, where was he an elder at? Is there any clue? There's really only one passage in scripture that gives us a clue where they were in their later years, and even that is very cryptic. But it's found in 1 Peter 5 and verse 13. It reads, "She who is in Babylon, chosen together with you, sends you greetings, and so does my son Mark." The Mark here is most likely John Mark. The word there for son is a Greek word that figuratively means kinship. And in fact, the people wonder who the she is. If you're reading from the King James, you won't see the word she. It says the church that is at Babylon. And so some people ask, well, who is the she and which Babylon? Is it figurative or is it literal? The she has a couple different widely accepted variations or interpretations. Some of the three main interpretations are the brotherhood. That fits the King James translators taking that position when they said the church who is in Babylon greets you. And from 1 Peter 1, 1-2, 1 Peter 2:17, and 1 Peter 5:9, when he refers to the brethren, it fits that. And it also King James uses where he says chosen together with you, says elected with you. And when we read the passages, whether Paul is using it or Peter uses it, when they talk about the elect or the chosen, they're talking about the church. So it says, "She who is in Babylon, chosen together with you," could be talking about the church, wherever Peter is at or wherever this Babylon is at. The second interpretation is it's referring to Peter's wife. I personally don't believe that. I believe he's talking about the church. The third one is some locally prominent lady. And again, I don't believe that's what he's talking about. I think the other passages through Peter, again, if you're writing them down, I don't have them on the slide. So that would be 1 Peter 1, 1-2, 1 Peter 2:17, and 1 Peter 5:9 are the three passages within the letter that makes me believe the she is referring to the church, which I agree with the King James translators on that. But it's also impossible to know which Babylon is meant. It could be one, the ancient city on the Euphrates. The name Babylon is the actual city Babylon. We know that in this time period, the writings of that time tell us there were many Jews on the Euphrates there by Babylon. It could be the name of a military station on the Nile in Egypt. Secular history records that John Mark took the gospel into Egypt, and there became a church there in that area near that military installation in Babylon. So some historians say he's got to be talking about where John Mark was at this military installation on the Nile. But then most people believe it's talking about Rome. This is the way it's used through, that many believe it's used through the book of Revelation. 1 Peter would predate Revelation. And so that would mean that if it is referring to Rome, that Peter used it that way before John did in Revelation. But whether it's talking about Babylon, the actual ancient city, or talking about figuratively Rome, it meant it was a long trip for Peter's wife from Capernaum. She traveled a long way with Peter. That's the ultimate point of all of this. Whether it's on the Nile in Egypt, whether it's the ancient city Babylon, or what I believe it's referring to in Rome, because of other secular writings that tell us Peter and his wife made it to Rome in their later years, she traveled a long way from Capernaum with her husband. From all of this, we can conclude that Peter's wife was his faithful companion during his very eventful life of a preacher of the gospel of Christ. And though unnamed, Peter's wife can be seen through the scriptures going from a fisherman's wife to a saint, a godly mother, an apostle's, and an elder's wife. From the text, we can see her being a helper to the man of faith who was her husband. She was the helpmeet that she was intended to be. Here's where I'm going to quote from secular history. Secular writings tell us that they did indeed reach Rome. In fact, some of the historians, one in particular, Jerome, gives very specific details. But I want you to notice, I'm going to go through from the first century into the third and fourth century, or the fourth, all the way from the fourth to the fifth century, actually, in these historians. Ignatius of Antioch, writing around AD 50 to 108, he is one of three men. Another one's going to be on this list. Polycarp, Clement of Rome, these are three men that lived during the time of the first century that are said to have been friends of the Apostle John. Polycarp is born about either 4 years or 1 year after the execution of Peter, so he wouldn't have known Peter. But Clement of Rome, Ignatius of Antioch, and Polycarp are said to have been friends of the apostles, namely, specifically, the Apostle John. And their writings, especially Ignatius of Antioch, were read in the churches along with the epistles of Paul, according to many of those writings from the first century into the second century. So Ignatius of Antioch would have had firsthand witness accounts of the apostles. Irenaeus of Lyons in 130 to 202, Clement of Alexandria, he lived from 150 to 215, and Jerome, writing from 327 to 420. You might say, why does Jerome ring a bell? I've talked about him a lot. He's the one that translated all the scriptures, Old and New Testament, into the Greek, or in the Latin that became the Latin Vulgate, and that was completed around 400 AD. So Jerome was a scribe and a scholar as well. All of these historians say that Peter spent his last years in Rome. Jerome, now he's writing from the 4th to the 5th century, he states Peter was there for 25 years to the end of his life. Now he's writing a few hundred years after the account, so I don't know how accurate that is, but it is interesting that he cites earlier sources saying that Peter and his wife did make it to Rome and that Peter was an elder there for 25 years. What we do know from history is they were present during the persecution of Christians in Rome by the Emperor Nero around AD 64 to 67. Rome was set on fire by Nero in 64, and to save face, he blamed it on the Christians, and a massive persecution arose to the point that he had 3,000 Christians crucified along the way to his palace, covered in tar and pitch, and lit on fire to light the way for his guests to a party. That was under Nero. And so there was mass persecution for those few years from 64 to 67, all the way until his last year, really, into 68. But secular history records they were both martyred in Rome. The story of the martyrdom of Peter and his wife is found within the pages of the History of the Church, Book 3, written by Eusebius. He's a historian of the early AD 300s, but I'm not going to be quoting from Eusebius. You see, he gives an earlier source, and he quotes from Clement of Rome. Clement of Rome wrote a book called, or I'm sorry, Clement of Alexandria, who wrote a book called the Stromata, which means miscellanies, book 7. And in chapter 11, he writes, remember Clement of Alexandria is from AD 150 to 215. He writes that Peter's wife suffered martyrdom just before Peter did. And again, all these quotes are on that source page that you can read all their different contributions to these histories. But I want to read now from what Clement of Alexandria says. He says, they say that when blessed Peter saw his wife led away to death, he was glad that her call had come and that she was returning home, and spoke to her in the most encouraging and comforting way, addressing her by name. Remember the Lord. He goes on to tell us that this was a term of endearment that Peter used for those that he loved and cared about. Remember the Lord. And that as he saw his wife being led to her death, he called out to her by name. Now, this doesn't tell us the name that was given. Somehow the computer became unplugged. I got it. I wish that he would have given us her name, but he doesn't. But he says Peter knew her name. He addressed her by name. And some of these accounts, as you, if you Google this, some of these accounts are going to quote this saying, thou or my dear, remember the Lord. But Clement of Alexandria doesn't use that. Going back to the earliest known source, he just says, Peter said, remember the Lord. Then after her death, many early histories record that Peter asked to be crucified upside down. Jerome, Clement of Rome, the apocryphal book from the second century, the Acts of Peter, Origen, who lived from 184 to 253. Clement of Rome was one of those three men I mentioned earlier. He lived from 35 to 99 and was said to be a friend of the Apostle John. They all say that he was crucified by Nero. While some historians only say he was crucified, others do say he asked to be crucified upside down, not counting himself worthy to be crucified in the same manner of Jesus. They all agree that he was crucified by Nero. Their dates may differ. Some say 65, the year after the fire. Some say 68, such as Jerome. Jerome says he was in Rome for 25 years and was put to death in the 14th year of Nero, which would be 68 AD. Jerome, again, gave very specifics. Whether it's 65 or 68, they all agree that Peter and his wife died in Rome. This could be the death that Jesus prophesied in John 21, 18 and 19. In 1 Peter chapter 1, 13 to 15, as Peter recounts that prophecy. Jesus told Peter, when you were younger, you used to go wherever you wanted to go. You dressed yourself and went. But when you're older, someone else is going to dress you and take you where you don't want to go. And then it tells us that he said this, specifying the kind of death Peter would die. I often wonder, in Acts chapter 12, we read that account where Peter's sleeping. And an angel coming to his rescue has to strike him in the side to wake him up. Either he was at peace with death and was going home to meet his Lord, or he was at peace knowing it wasn't going to happen because Jesus said, when you're old, it's going to happen. And so he didn't know how or why it would take place, but he knew it would. Either way, Peter lived to be that old man. He had served as an elder at the church. From the small record of Peter's wife, we can see a picture of a hospitable, godly wife and mother, and a faithful companion to an apostle and an elder of the church. She was faithful both to her husband and to the Lord. And if the histories are correct, then she was faithful to the end. We find that the Romans, as they would put a Christian to death, always gave them the choice: denounce Jesus and live. And part of denouncing Jesus is they were supposed to light a candle or incense, and sometimes they were led in a prayer to Caesar. It wasn't enough just to say, I denounce Christ. They then had to worship Caesar to prove it. And by her going to her death, the historians record she did not denounce Jesus, but went on to live with him forever. We may not know her name, but we can see her godly example and learn from it. And I hope it's been an encouragement to you, as it was to me, putting all of this together. A woman that's not named, barely found in the scriptures, but yet so much can be gleaned from the passages we know because of who Peter was, and especially knowing he was an elder and what it meant to be an elder's wife. This morning, if you're not a Christian, you need to be. You can repent of your sins. You can be baptized for the forgiveness of those sins today, rising from the waters, no longer guilty, standing before God accused, but standing before God walking in newness of life. And if you are a Christian this morning, not living the way that you should, don't continue in sin. But as we see the example of Peter and his ups and downs, we're going to have those ups and downs in our life. But like Peter, we need to be able to return back to God, strengthening our brethren. And if this describes your condition this morning, we invite you to come forward. Let your request be known now. All together we stand, and while we sing.